Good evening all, and I would like to start by thanking the organizers, institutions and individuals who organized this event and invited me to talk in this conference first. So learning and generating knowledge about extreme violence in conflict settings is very tricky and difficult because simply you cannot design your research in these circumstances in isolation of what's happening around you. And usually there are other burning priorities for life-saving activities rather than proper research that look at documenting lessons learned from these experiences. But at the same time, it's really essential to draw lessons from these experiences. And I think the best way is to learn from humanitarian actors, human rights defenders, and other practitioners who witnessed these incidents, and they should be able to report back on these lessons. So I would reflect on the Syrian context first as a Syrian and as a humanitarian worker when I was leading the health response of Save the Children between 2013 and 2017 in northwest Syria, in the areas Idlib and Aleppo areas controlled by rebels. And second, the reflection as a researcher, because in the last 2 or 3 years, I was working extensively on research on the health humanitarian response in Syria with institutions like London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Chatham House, and King's College, where I'm currently working. So the main topic that I will talk about is attacks on healthcare or violence against healthcare in general. And I worked on a research with Chatham House last year. And Chatham House, for I think you are familiar with Chatham House, but just to define it, it's a think tank. It's called the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. So I worked with them last year on a research paper around how to report attacks on healthcare, looking at the different reporting mechanisms of reporting attacks on healthcare in conflict settings. So I will talk mainly about attacks on healthcare, but at the same time, I will mention the need for building the research capacity for humanitarian actors, both local and international ones. And that's what we are doing now in King's College. We have a project called Research for Health in Conflict in the Middle East, funded by the UK Research Council, to try to build the capacity for local, especially for local NGOs and international NGOs, to be able to document and conduct proper research in conflict settings. So the topic of attacks on healthcare has gained significant international attention in the last decade, leading to the UN Security Resolution 2286 on the protection of healthcare during conflict. Also, the World Health Assembly Resolution 65.20 in 2012, which tasked the WHO to lead efforts to document and report attacks on healthcare. So starting with reflection of my personal experience as a Syrian medical doctor and as a humanitarian worker. In 2012, a year after the spark of the Syrian crisis, I was doing my neurosurgery training program in Aleppo City. And the whole program was 7 years, and I was seven years, so I was halfway through my training program when demonstrations reached to Aleppo City. And I tried my best to stick to the medical oath and to treat people from different sides equally, but sometimes I was not allowed to do so. So security agencies and intelligence agencies, they were watching closely medical doctors who treat protesters or who show some sympathy with injured people during demonstrations. And therefore, one option was to treat patients at home. And a lot of doctors were treating patients at home to avoid being watched by security agencies. In this period, a lot of my colleagues were detained or even sometimes killed under torture by the Sinan regime because they caught them treating protesters. And in one incident in 2012, I think in June 2012, there was an incident in a neighborhood in Aleppo City called Saif al-Dawla, where the security agencies, they found a filled hospital treating protesters, and they burned the filled hospital, and two medical students were burned in this filled hospital in this incident. And then in the summer of 2012, when the Free Syrian Army or the opposition forces, they broke into Aleppo City. So Aleppo City was divided into two parts. And I was in the regime-held area, right, doing my training program. But I tried to help people from both sides. And I noticed that people in the eastern side of Aleppo, they were not able to access healthcare, either because of the road blockages or even fearing being arrested by security agencies if they sought healthcare in governmental hospitals. So I tried to move between the two parts of the city to try to help people from both sides. But at some point, it was not possible to continue like this. I remember a day, which was, I think, Saturday, the 25th or 26th of December 2012. I was in a theater in Al Razi Hospital in Aleppo. I was conducting a general surgery operation. And then a nurse came into the theater and he whispered in my ear that the security agencies, they are looking for you in the emergency department downstairs. I had only 1 minute to change my clothes and escape from the hospital covered by a network of nurses. And at that point, I found out that it's impossible to continue moving between the two parts of the city. And I moved to the eastern part of Aleppo, where a group of doctors, they established field hospitals. And I established the field hospital in a basement of a mosque in Al-Sukkari neighborhood in Aleppo City. A few weeks later, this hospital was bombed. I was not there when it was bombed, but I had to move again and again to working in different field hospitals. And it was not clear for us in the beginning if these attacks on health facilities, if it's deliberate or if it's only like collateral damage while they were bombarding the whole area. When I moved to the north, to the northern countryside of Idlib, I identified several other needs because a lot of NGOs, they were focusing on trauma and injuries because of the nature of the crisis. But actually, there were further health needs. And the areas that I identified, the first one was the need to strengthen the health system. Because after the capture of these areas by rebels, the Ministry of Health, the Damascus Ministry of Health, they withdrawn from all these areas. And the health system there collapsed. So there was a need to re-establish the health system in these areas. So most NGOs, they came up with a parallel health system to provide health services. But a group of local medical staff and local doctors, they tried to establish a sort of health system to coordinate the health response better and to fill the gap that was produced by the withdrawal of the Ministry of Health in Damascus. So this is an area that I put a lot of efforts in this regard. And there was something called Idlib Medical Council or the Idlib Health Directorate, which was developing extensively in the years between 2013 and 2017, till they reached to a very functional health system, which is now supported by the GIZ, the German fund. But the other point that I identified was vaccination. And at that time, in 2013, I joined Save the Children International, where we've done, we designed the health interventions to cover mainly primary healthcare, to cover vaccination from one hand and primary healthcare centers and reproductive health from the other hand. And our hospital, we had a hospital in northern Idlib, a maternity hospital. This hospital was attacked or was hit by an airstrike in 2016. Even a maternity hospital was hit. So we identified the need to report these attacks, to document and report these attacks. So focusing on the reporting, or talking about reporting attacks on healthcare, in the beginning, it was not captured as an area of priority by health actors. And most local health actors were not reporting these attacks because they, or not documenting these attacks because they thought that maybe only reporting it to media would be enough. And I recall an incident in 2012 where a hospital, Al Shifa Hospital in eastern Aleppo, which is a 7-floor hospital, was bombed to the ground. And when I, a few years later, when I searched about incident reports about this attack, I did not find any incident report talking about this single attack. Despite there were a lot of media reports about it, but there were no NGOs reports or internal reporting procedures for such incidents. And in 2012, 2013, some NGOs started to report. And I think one of the first organizations that used to report attacks on healthcare in Syria was Physicians for Human Rights, BHR. So they started early 2012. And the good thing, the interactions between Physicians for Human Rights and other human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch and other organizations, local actors, they learned about the importance of this reporting and documenting these attacks. And in 2014, local health organizations, they started to document these attacks. Like example, the Syrian Medical, Syrian American Medical Society, SAMS, and USM, the Union for Medical Relief, Medical and Relief Organizations, they started reporting attacks on healthcare in 2014. And their methodology was evolving and developing over time. And now they have a very functioning system of reporting. And later, late 2015, the health cluster in Gaza Intab, led by WHO, they developed an innovative approach of reporting attacks on healthcare, which is called Monitoring Violence Against Healthcare, MVH tool. And the innovative side of MVH, that it employ all the health actors and the members of the health cluster, they employ all their efforts to report attacks on healthcare. So they use WhatsApp messages, and at the same time they use an anonymized online reporting tool to report attacks on healthcare. And this tool was perceived very positively by health actors, especially local health actors, because it was easy to use, and it captured most the incidents happening in the field of violence against healthcare. So it has three or five verification steps. So it starts with the health cluster members sending alerts of incidents, either on WhatsApp or online, and then field staff of these NGOs or other health cluster members, they were asked to seek further information through interviews with eyewitnesses. The third one is triangulation of data through different sources and sending flash updates to health cluster members. The fourth step is to seek some data from external partners like Physicians for Human Rights. And lastly, there was monthly verification process, or sometimes even more frequent, to reach the final incidents list of each month. However, this reporting tool was replaced by another reporting tool, which is the it's called the SSA, which is the surveillance system of attacks, which is a tool developed by WHO in late 2017 or 16, because as we mentioned, the World Health Assembly tasked WHO by leading efforts to document attacks on healthcare. So they developed this tool to be a systematic tool of reporting attacks on healthcare. However, they are, based on the research that we conducted in Chatham House last year, which hopefully will be published soon, there are some areas that maybe this tool could be even further improved, areas such as geographical coverage, taxonomy, and categorization, the type of data variables they collect, and the type of actors involved in reporting. So maybe these areas, they need to be looked at and considered while developing the SSA tool even further. So after reporting attacks on healthcare by the NVH, local health actors, after a few years of reporting, they were less motivated to continue reporting attacks on healthcare. Why? Because they did not notice that this reporting is making any difference, right? So this reporting is not protecting their health facilities, because they thought that if we have reported these attacks, then our hospitals will be protected. But this was not the case. In 2016 only, there was 200 attacks on health facilities. So even after the start of this reporting mechanism, it seems the number of attacks increased. So local actors, they felt less motivated to continue reporting because they did not see the point of this reporting if it's not protecting their facilities. So that's why there was some debate about a different procedures called the deconflection procedures, which is a procedure led by UN OCHA, the Office for Coordinating the Humanitarian Affairs. So basically, the health actors were requested to share the coordinates, the geographical coordinates of their health facilities with the UN OCHA. So the UN OCHA would share these coordinates with the different parties to the conflict in order to provide some protection for health facilities. And a lot of health actors, Syrian health actors, they did not agree to share these coordinates. Why? Because they said, okay, if we are sharing the coordinates with the Syrian regime and Russian, then it would be even easier for them to target our facilities. And they have all the right to say so, because there is an evidence that in the last few years, Syrian regime and their allies, they were the ones who's targeting the facilities, as per Physicians for Human Rights, Human Rights Watch, and a lot of actors who reported these incidents. And after 1 or 2 years of debating among Syrian NGOs, all of them, actually, or at least 90% of them, last year, they agreed to share the coordinates of their hospitals. Why? Basically, because they did not have any other option. And they said, okay, if our hospitals are being targeted anyway, so let's share our coordinates with UN OCHA and see. And then at least we have like another factor or another card to use in our advocacy, that despite we shared the coordinates of our hospitals, these hospitals were hit again and again. But the problem that within this deconflection process, there is no guarantee of any protection. So even the UN OCHA would say, okay, you're sharing your coordinates, but we do not have any guarantee that these hospitals or facilities would be protected. But they shared last year, and now they said, we need maybe to use this evidence that if this hospital, the coordinates was shared, and then this hospital was targeted, then we can use this, if we documented properly the incidents, we can use this in courts or accountability measures. But they identified that there is no court system that is responsible to deal with the Syrian crisis until this point. Why? Because the UN Security Council was not able to establish any court specifically for the Syrian case because of the vetoes by mainly Russia and China. Instead, the Security Council, they established something else called the Trouble IM. It's called the International Independent Something Monitoring System, which is a system that it's not funded properly, but it's looking at collating documents and evidence on violations against human rights, including attacks on healthcare. So a lot of Syrian NGOs, they went and shared whatever evidence they have with the Trouble IM, hoping that at some point this evidence and this information will be used somewhere. And a lot of Syrian NGOs were shocked when they knew that even the International Criminal Court cannot deal with the Syrian case. Why? Because Syria is not a signatory country. But there were some talk that maybe other countries affected by the Syrian crisis, like example Jordan, they were affected because of the refugees, they can apply or they can raise a case in the International Criminal Court because they were affected. So basically, to sum up on the issue of attacks on healthcare, based on the research that we've done in Chatham House last year, and this research employed both quantitative evidence, because we collected data from all actors who report attacks on healthcare in Syria, and then focus group discussions and interviews with health actors. So we identified a few points that should be considered while reporting attacks on healthcare in conflict settings. Some of these points, first, the principles of reporting. For example, subjectivity and impartiality and independence should be considered or should be substantial principles for any reporting mechanism for attacks on healthcare in conflict settings. And then the reporting tool should be standardized and systematic to allow for comparison between different contexts and to be used in the same way by different actors. And the type of data that need to be collected should not be only limited to the incident itself, but also it should capture some information about context and circumstances and impact. And then the taxonomy and the terminology used in reporting attacks on healthcare should be standardized as possible to be used by different actors in the same way. And the verification process should invest more in all primary and secondary data sources that exist, especially data sources from local actors. And there is a need to build the capacity for local actors to be able to report these incidents. And then expand the partnerships and networks. Like example, the SSA that I mentioned, the WHO reporting mechanism, rely mainly on WHO offices with the involvement of their partners, but I think they need to expand even this network further to include local NGOs and local actors. So back to the Syrian case again, but I don't think that reporting is enough. Because as we said, a lot of local NGOs, they produced a lot of data and a lot of evidence, but they had nowhere to go with this evidence and reporting. And some people argue, what's the purpose of reporting attacks on healthcare? Is it only to maintain the functionality of the health response, or is it to do with accountability, with justice? And I think we cannot separate the two purposes. Some people argue that we should separate the two purposes, but I don't think we can separate between them in the whole process. So the other thing that I looked at when analyzing the data related to attacks on healthcare is analyzing the different patterns and time of occurrence of these incidents and the different circumstances and impact. And I think analyzing this information gave us some indications of the motivations behind these attacks. Because in the beginning, we thought that these attacks, it's only like a collateral damage, maybe, of what's happening. But then when analyzing the circumstances, it seems that these attacks is part of a process of a military tactic to not only gain military victory, but as well to maybe have long-term issues like forced displacement or geographic demographic engineering. And I will give here two examples to illustrate this argument. The first example is in December 2016, when the regime recontrolled the eastern part of Aleppo city. So in the beginning, the regime besieged the eastern part of the city, and for months, and even for humanitarian actors, we were not able to enter the eastern part of the city. And after months, the second tactic would be to target civilian infrastructure in general, so people would not only starve but also would be affected physically by the airstrikes and bombardments. And then the third step would be to target specifically healthcare. Why? Because if they are targeting civilians and civilian neighborhoods, and then civilians would not find a health facilities to go and seek healthcare, then they will be more prone to accept whatever deal suggested. So the fourth step would be to propose evacuation deals. And these evacuation deals would come in a context of a humanitarian corridors, but with only one way. It's not two ways corridors. It's only to push people to flee their homes to certain areas. And humanitarian actors will not be allowed to use the same corridors for humanitarian purposes. So we cannot call them humanitarian corridors. And the five step, if all was not successful in pushing opposition forces to surrender and in pushing civilians to flee their homes, the last step could be chemical weapons. And this was used in Aleppo extensively. The chlorine was used extensively in the urban areas to push people to accept the deals, even if they do not want to leave the city. The same scenario happened in rural Damascus in February 2018, when the regime recontrolled Reef Dimashq, or the rural Damascus. The same tactic happened. You know, for besiegement, it was used for months and months. And maybe you remember the story of Madaya, which is only a few kilometers away from Damascus, where most UN agencies and a lot of NGOs are based. But they were starving for months and even years. And, you know, more than 70 cases of death were documented as a result of starvation after this besiegement. And then the targeting of civilian infrastructure, including schools, including civilian neighborhoods and medical infrastructure. Only in February 2018, SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, they reported more than 30 medical facility that was hit by this military campaign in 2018. And then the deal. Yes, there was a deal to evacuate most the residents of rural Damascus and send them to Idlib, to the north. And when one city has not accepted the deal, which is Douma city, then the solution was a chemical weapon. And now it's confirmed that a chemical weapon was used in Douma in March 2018. And only 4 days after the use of chemical weapon, they accepted the deal and they evacuated the city. So to conclude, the I think humanitarian actors should be involved more in research and in producing and documenting knowledge in these contexts. And that's why in King's College, in the Research for Health and Conflict, we try to build the capacity for not only international NGOs, but also local actors to be able to develop their research skills on three levels: individuals, organizations like NGOs, institutions like universities and governments, and to be able to document these lessons to be used in different contexts. Thank you.